Welcome back, fellow baseball card collectors.
Glad to be back.
You already know exactly what time of year it is.
Oh, absolutely.
And, well, you know exactly why you were here.
Is that time?
It is time for Cardboardum's annual Rollic Card Recap.
The one we wait all year for.
Now, for the very few of you who might be new to this specific corner of the hobby, I'll keep the orientation pretty brief.
Just the basics, right?
Every year, we look forward to this chronicle from the Virginia-based blogger. He takes perfectly good, authentic pieces of vintage cardboard.
Which is crazy to begin with.
It is. And he subjects them to a full 12 months of just unprotected pocket-dwelling existence.
From one birthday to the exact next birthday.
Exactly. These cards just live in a leather wallet. They face the friction, the humidity, and the sheer unpredictability of the outside world.
Usually we expect stories about, you know, bent corners.
Yeah, maybe a coffee spill.
Or the absolute terror of accidentally sending the wallet through the washing machine.
Right, the standard hazards. But before we get into the thick of this year's chronicle, I really need to issue a serious warning right up front.
A very necessary warning.
What you are about to hear is, it is not the standard run-of-the-mill retrospective.
Not at all.
I promise you, as we go through these events today, they are going to sound entirely unbelievable.
They really push the boundaries of statistical probability.
Yeah, they're going to sound like you've wandered into some magical realism novel or like a bizarre, highly stylized indie film script.
But we have to assure everyone.
I assure you right off the bat, this is not a work of fiction.
Every single bit of this is entirely true.
I am still trying to wrap my head around half of it, honestly.
When you look at the sheer density of bizarre occurrences this year, it challenges how we even perceive coincidence.
It really does. So to set the stage for you, let's look at the two protagonists chosen for this 12-month journey.
The Odd Couple.
Cardboardum selected two real-life brothers, rendered in cardboard, to act as the literal angel and devil on his shoulders.
A brilliant psychological pairing.
Card number one represents order, discipline, and just absolute steadfast reliability.
It's a 1982 Topps-traded Cal Ripken card.
The Iron Man himself.
Right. A card representing a player whose entire legacy is built on just showing up.
Doing the work.
Doing the work and weathering the daily grind without a single complaint.
And then, well, there's card number two.
Counterbalance.
The counterbalance. The embodiment of pure, unadulterated chaos.
The infamous 1989 Fleer Billy Ripken F-Face Error card.
For those who might have somehow forgotten, this is the legendary card where Billy is casually posing with his bat resting right on his shoulder.
And written in clear, undeniable black Sharpie on the knob of that bat.
It's a very specific, very hyphenated profanity.
Yes.
We will be referring to it as the F-Face card today, just to keep things clean.
Well, you all know the one.
Oh, everyone knows the one.
Yeah.
But to really grasp the trajectory of the journey these two cards take, we have to establish the overarching metaphor that Cardboardum uses to frame this entire year.
He views this 12-month span through a very specific concept.
The concept of the tolling bell.
Right. When I was looking over his notes, that bell metaphor felt incredibly heavy.
It casts a massive shadow over the very first paragraph of his account.
Because the tolling bell is one of our oldest cultural signifiers of finality.
Yeah.
If you look at the literary canon, John Donne famously told us, "Ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee."
Ernest Hemingway titled an absolute masterpiece after
Metallica it. Metallica wrote a legendary thrash metal anthem about it.
Of course.
Throughout history, the slow, sonorous ringing of a heavy bell was a broadcast to the community that they were poorer by one soul.
But Cardboardum flips that interpretation, right?
He does. He suggests that those deep tones aren't commemorating something that is already concluded.
They are harbingers.
Exactly. It's a countdown clock.
Countdown to something physically breaking.
Think about the actual physical math of destruction here. A bell is a marvel of metallurgical engineering.
And mathematical precision.
Right. Its curved shape, the varying thickness of the lip, the specific alloy of bronze or brass, it is all calibrated to exact, unforgiving ratios.
So when the clapper strikes, it's supposed to produce pure, resonant harmony.
But what happens if you introduce a tiny microscopic hairline fracture into that metal?
The math breaks down.
It completely shatters. The sound waves cannot travel properly.
The pure harmony instantly turns into this discordant, ugly vibration.
And here is the truly tragic, inevitable part of that physics equation.
Yeah.
Each subsequent toll of the bell propagates physical stress directly through that weakened metal.
Wow.
every single strike fatigues the materia just a little bit further.
Micromillimeter by micromillimeter.
Widening the fracture. The bell effectively becomes an instrument of its own demise.
It's hastening the moment when the cracks spread beyond the point of structural integrity.
Until it fragments catastrophically. The bell literally tolls itself to death.
And that brings us directly to our two pieces of cardboard, because both of them went into the wallet with a latent flaw.
Cal had a tiny hairline crease on the back, just a small imperfection in the paper stock.
But Billy.
Yeah, Billy.
Billy's flaw was loudly, proudly broadcast right there on the knob of his bat.
His card was metaphorically ringing its own funeral bell from the second it came off the printing press back in 1989.
One card was destined to live a life of quiet moderation, just hoping to survive the year through sheer endurance.
While the other was built for excess, actively inviting chaos.
Anyone familiar with the hobby knew exactly which one was going to break first.
It was inevitable.
Our mission today is to unpack how these cardboard siblings bickered from inside a leather prison.
How they seemingly warped reality around them.
And how they ultimately teamed up to orchestrate an absolute masterpiece of an event before Billy's bloody spectacular demise. Okay, let's unpack this.
The journey begins, fittingly enough, on the morning after Cardboardum's birthday.
And it starts with an attempt at physical atonement.
Let me guess. The traditional birthday indulgences got a little out of hand. To put it mildly, he describes this massive sugary donut breakfast.
Oh, man.
Followed later by a heavy, incredibly rich birthday dinner of bulgogi.
Which was specifically chosen by his daughter.
Right. So waking up the next morning, feeling the weight of those caloric choices, he decides he needs a morning run.
He slips the wallet right into his pocket.
And they head out to the forested trails of the Jamestown settlement.
His route is designed to wind through the woods.
I just love visualizing the dynamic inside the pocket right here. The starting bell rings.
Cal Ripken is probably lacing up his imaginary spikes.
Checking his pulse.
Ready for the discipline of a 3-mile trail segment. He's the Iron Man. This is entirely his element.
Meanwhile, Billy is just completely miserable.
You can totally picture his jersey completely untucked.
He's grumbling about being woken up before noon.
Probably nursing a metaphorical hangover.
Just furious about the humidity and the exercise.
Mm-hmm.
But the universe immediately starts offering up signs of the chaos that Billy brings to the table.
How far into the run?
Just a short ways into the trail. They encounter a footbridge.
Yeah.
And posted right there is a bright yellow safety sign that reads, "Slippery when wet."
Please tell me Billy had a reaction to that.
According to the blog, this is where the personalities vividly clash for the very first time.
Okay.
Billy starts giggling uncontrollably. He points at the sign. And keeping in character with his own infamous error card, he somehow has an imaginary Sharpie ready.
Oh, no.
He offers to fix the sign to make it a little more entertaining.
And Cal is just standing there, shaking his head, realizing he has to spend an entire year locked in a leather pouch with a guy named F-Face who wants to vandalize park property.
Exactly.
They obviously don't let Billy touch the sign, but the omens just keep stacking up. What happens next?
Half a mile past the bridge, Billy tugs at Cardboardum's metaphorical shirt and points to the edge of the trail.
Yeah.
Sitting right there in the woods, looking completely unfazed by the runners, is a squirrel holding a discarded cigarette butt in its tiny paws.
A squirrel holding a cigarette. That is the most hyper-specific, grimy, woodland image I've ever heard.
Cardboardum immediately dubs it Billy's spirit animal.
Yeah, I can see why.
And the encounters just continue to escalate from there. They move into a more open section of the sandy trail, and the bell rings a bit louder.
What's blocking the path?
Standing its ground with absolute prehistoric menace is a snapping turtle.
Knowing Billy's energy, he probably wanted to wrestle the thing.
He essentially channels his inner late-night cable wildlife host, narrating the encounter and actively trying to provoke this incredibly aggressive reptile.
And Cal.
It's Cal who steps in as the voice of reason and education.
Always the responsible one.
Cal advises keeping a respectful distance, noting the surrounding sandy soil. He points out that this is likely a female turtle returning to her swamp after laying eggs.
So Cal basically turns a sweaty morning run of regret into a PBS nature documentary.
He really does. He even spots a nearby beaver dam and takes a moment to thoughtfully observe that, you know, Billy actually looks a little bit like a beaver.
That is an amazing dig from the older brother.
Sibling rivalry at its finest.
But the educational field trip doesn't stop with the wildlife, does it?
No, the terrain itself is just dripping with history. As they continue running, they approach the edge of Mainland Farm.
For those who aren't familiar with Virginia history, this is America's oldest continually cultivated farm.
Dating back 4 centuries.
There's ancient, abandoned, horse-drawn agricultural equipment just rusting away in the woods.
Billy is yawning, basically trying to take a nap on the rusty iron machinery.
But Cal is energized.
He starts delivering this profound historical lecture because this land was once part of the Green Spring Plantation.
Green Spring? That name rings a bell from Revolutionary War history, but I can't quite place the specific battle.
What's fascinating here is the sheer absurdity of the military encounter that took place on this exact soil in 1781. It perfectly sets the philosophical tone for Billy's entire worldview.
Set the scene for us. What is happening in 1781 that ends up validating the existence of the F-face card?
We are in the late stages of the American Revolution. The Marquis de Lafayette has finally received reinforcements.
Okay.
And he is closely tracking the movements of British General Cornwallis. Through his scouts, Lafayette observes Cornwallis preparing to move his massive, heavily armed army across the mile-wide James River.
A huge undertaking.
Right. The scouts report boats being loaded with soldiers and making the crossing. Lafayette sees what he thinks is a golden once-in-a-campaign opportunity.
He believes Cornwallis is vulnerable.
Yes. So he dispatches American General Manton Wayne with about 800 troops to quickly strike and capture the British rear guard that seems to be left behind on the shore.
That sounds like solid military strategy. Catch them while they're divided by a massive body of water?
It would have been, except it was a trap.
A trap.
A brilliantly orchestrated, devastating trap. The British fully intended to cross the river eventually, but at that moment, they were completely faking the crossing.
They were just loading empty boats.
Loading empty boats or cycling the same troops back and forth just to draw Lafayette's forces into a battle on terrain chosen by the British.
And the terrain is the crucial element here.
That swampy, sandy soil, the exact same environment inhabited by the snapping turtles and beavers that our wallet cards just ran past, forced Lafayette's men to approach through these narrow, elevated causeways.
It created a natural, inescapable choke point.
Exactly.
So Manton Wayne is marching 800 men down a narrow strip of land into a swamp, who is waiting for him on the other side.
Not a small, vulnerable rear guard. Cornwallis had quietly lined the surrounding area with more than 4,000 highly trained British regulars, heavily supported by field artillery. And the leadership of these units is what makes it truly terrifying.
Who was commanding them?
These forces included contingents commanded by the infamous traitor Benedict Arnold.
Oh, wow.
And the utterly ruthless cavalry commander Bannister Tarleton.
Cardboardham points out in his blog that Billy's only real frame of reference for the American Revolution is the Mel Gibson movie, The Patriot.
Which is historically dubious at best.
Right. So Billy is genuinely shocked to discover that Tarleton wasn't dramatically killed in a duel by a flag-wielding Mel Gibson, but was actually right here on this literal jogging trail waiting in the woods to butcher the Americans.
The historical reality hits him hard. So Manton Wayne's 800 men rush headlong into this engineered kill zone.
The jaws of the trap snap shut before Lafayette can arrive with the rest of the army to support them.
Wayne finds himself in an absolute nightmare scenario. He is holding an indefensible position in a swamp, completely outgunned and outnumbered 5-1.
If he orders his men to turn around and retreat, they will be run down from behind and slaughtered by Tarleton's cavalry in a complete chaotic rout.
That's a total checkmate.
What does a commander even do in that situation?
He leans into his nickname. Facing a 5-1 disadvantage and certain death, Manton Wayne doesn't retreat.
He attacks.
He orders a full, aggressive bayonet charge directly into the center of the massive British line.
That goes against every rule of military engagement. It sounds completely suicidal. You don't charge an entrenched force 5 times your size.
It defies all logic. But strategically, it was a stroke of chaotic, unhinged genius.
No, so.
The sheer audacity of 800 men screaming and charging with fixed bayonets sowed massive, instantaneous confusion among the British ranks.
Cornwallis and his seasoned officers simply could not compute the action.
They assumed that no sane commander would order a charge like that unless it was a diversion for an even larger, more devastating trap that the Americans were springing.
Believing they were about to be flanked by Lafayette's hidden main force.
Exactly. So the British halted their attack and shifted into a defensive posture to absorb the blow.
They blinked. The overwhelming force hesitated because the Americans acted too crazy to be defeated.
That hesitation was everything. That brief defensive pause gave the Americans the tiny window they needed to reverse their orders, break off the charge, and hastily but safely retreat back down the causeways.
To the safety of Lafayette's approaching reinforcements. The British trap completely failed.
Cornwallis eventually abandoned the pursuit, moved his forces on, and just a few months later, he surrendered at nearby Yorktown.
Which effectively ended the war. And what does Billy Ripken, the patron saint of bad decisions, take away from this incredible tale of military survival?
He concludes that stupidity is sometimes a feature, not a bug.
It perfectly encapsulates his entire chaotic alignment.
If you do something so wildly irrational, so completely outside the bounds of expected behavior, that the universe or the British Army cannot process it, you might just survive.
That dynamic between Cal's deep reverence for history and Billy's sheer appreciation for unadulterated survivalist chaos really defines the next phase of their year in the wallet.
Cal decides that Billy's worldview is too feral. He needs refinement. He needs to experience high culture.
Cal is an appreciator of intersecting narratives and profound emotional truths. He wants to elevate his brother.
So the cultural education begins with a trip to the theater. Cardboardum takes the wallet to a stage production of Les Miserables.
I am absolutely obsessed with the visual of this. You have Cal Ripken, this stoic symbol of steadfast order and baseball purity, sitting in the dark theater, literally crying during Eponine's heartbreaking rendition of On My Own.
It's a very touching scene.
And what is the F-face card doing? He is practically standing on his chair, raising a glass, and loudly cheering for the Thénardier.
The corrupt scam artist innkeepers who steal from everyone. Billy recognizes his own kind.
Of course he does.
Cal tries to pivot from the theater to culinary refinement. He demands a breakfast that isn't sugary donuts.
Taking them to a French bistro for a complex, beautifully prepared cassoulet featuring duck confit.
He even tries to connect Billy to their shared cardboard heritage by visiting the historical site of the American Tobacco Company's primary factory in Richmond.
That site is sacred ground for anyone who collects cards. That parking deck sits exactly where the ATC used to insert the legendary T206 tobacco cards into cigarette packs over a century ago.
You're talking about the birthplace of the Honus Wagner card?
Cal is trying to show Billy the roots of their existence, but this entire cultural education program reaches its absolute peak and its most hilarious failure when they visit a fine art gallery.
The gallery visit is a spectacular collision of high art and lowbrow humor. They attend a highly curated exhibit featuring Michelangelo's original preparatory sketches for the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel.
The gallery rules are strict, right? Absolutely no photography is allowed of the actual fragile sketches.
So Cardboardum settles for posing the cards in front of a massive illuminated sign outside the exhibit that displays the most iconic panel of the entire work.
The creation of Adam.
The famous image of God reaching out, finger extended, to give the spark of life to the first man.
Right. But Cardboardum manages to position his camera and the wallet so perfectly that the finger of God, reaching out across the cosmos, is directly touching the profane word written on the knob of Billy Ripken's bat.
God is literally bestowing the divine spark of life onto the F-face card.
I imagine Billy interpreting that as the Almighty giving him a high five. But there is a deeper layer here. Cardboardum taps into some serious art history to show that the bell is faintly tolling the absurd.
Because Michelangelo himself might have appreciated the joke.
It is a profound connection. When we think of Michelangelo, we think of the austere, divine figure of the Renaissance.
His contemporaries literally referred to him as Il Divino, the divine one.
But what the history books often gloss over is that Michelangelo was an incredible, vindictive, historical troll.
He possessed a chaotic, rebellious streak that perfectly mirrors the energy Billy represents.
Tell me about this, because I always pictured him as this deeply serious, pious artist suffering for his craft.
He suffered, but he also retaliated. During the years he spent painting the Last Judgment fresco on the altar wall of the Sistine Chapel, he faced severe criticism.
From who?
The papal master of ceremonies, a very powerful man named Biagio da Cesena, came to inspect the work.
And he wasn't happy.
Biagio loudly and publicly objected to the immense amount of nudity in the artwork. He called it an utter disgrace and declared that it belonged in a public tavern or a bathhouse, not the private chapel of the Pope.
You do not insult Il Divino in his own workspace. How did Michelangelo handle the critique?
He handled it permanently. Yeah. He painted Biagio da Cesena directly into hell on the fresco.
Wow.
Specifically, he depicted this high-ranking papal official as Minos, the judge of the underworld.
But he didn't stop at just painting his face for everyone to recognize.
No, he gave him giant donkey ears to broadcast his foolishness to the world.
And in a stroke of absolute petty genius, he painted a massive snake wrapping tightly around his body, with the snake's fang sinking directly into Biagio's groin.
That is next-level vengeance. Having a snake bite your groin on the wall of the Pope's chapel for all of eternity.
Biagio was furious, understandably. He went straight to the Pope and demanded the insulting portrait be removed.
But the Pope supposedly laughed and told him that while papal jurisdiction extended to heaven and purgatory, he unfortunately had no authority over hell, so the painting had to stay.
But Michelangelo's rebellion didn't stop there. Let's look back at the creation of Adam, the very painting Billy was posing with. Do you know who Michelangelo used as the model for the face of God?
Let me guess. Himself.
Himself. He painted his own face as the Almighty Creator.
Think about the layers of that inside joke. You have this artist painting his own self-portrait as God.
Forever winking down at Pope Julius II, who commissioned the work, and winking at every single college of cardinals that would ever gather in that room to elect a new pope for the next five centuries.
It is a multi-layered middle finger to authority that has survived for half a millennium under the guise of sacred art.
When you frame it that way, Michelangelo's masterpiece perfectly aligns with the chaotic energy of the Billy Ripken error card. It's high art imitating low life, imitating cardboard.
It's a profound scholarly connection wrapped entirely in a profane joke.
But as the year progresses, that chaotic energy stops being just a funny lens to view history through.
It starts to actively bleed into the family's everyday excursions.
Billy isn't just reacting to his environment anymore. He seems to be altering the frequency of reality around him.
You really start to feel the shift. They go down to the Outer Banks in North Carolina for a relaxing Mother's Day weekend. They are up early, walking the beach, and the ocean puts on a show.
They witness a whale spy hopping, literally poking its massive head straight up out of the water to look around.
An hour later, card boredom snaps a photo of Billy at the water's edge. And if you look closely, you can see a pod of four dolphins moving up the shoreline just over the corner of the card.
It's idyllic, it's peaceful, but then they go inside to grab breakfast at the hotel restaurant.
And the audio landscape of the room goes completely surreal.
Right. They sit down, and the restaurant is playing this bland, smooth jazz instrumental music over the speakers, but Cardboredom realizes something feels off about the melodies.
The rhythm is weirdly familiar.
He stops talking, listens closely, and realizes they're listening to AI-generated saxophone-heavy smooth jazz covers of the grunge band Nirvana.
And it's not just a randomized playlist.
The AI jazz is playing the entire track list of the Nevermind album, perfectly in sequence, track by track.
You can vividly picture Billy cackling at the table while Cal shoots him a look of deep, concerned disapproval.
The juxtaposition of Kurt Cobain's raw, generation-defining angst translated into soulless AI-generated hotel lobby jazz is peak modern absurdity.
The weirdness follows them back to Virginia. They make a stop in Norfolk at a legendary diner and drive-in called Dumars.
Now, this place is special.
Dumars is a fascinating case study in resilience, which resonates with the whole wallet card project. It has been operating continuously for over 90 years.
The founder, Abe Dumar, is the man famously credited with inventing the ice cream cone at the 1904 World's Fair by rolling up a waffle.
The very next year, in 1905, he commissioned a custom-built heavy iron machine to mass-produce these perfect cones.
And the craziest part of the story is the sheer survivability of that machine. The original Dumars ice cream stand was located right on the boardwalk, and it was completely annihilated by a massive hurricane.
The building was gone.
But that heavy iron cone-making machine survived the wreckage intact. Today, over a century later, it sits right inside the front door of the current diner, and they still use it every single day to bake all of Dumars' cones.
It's a beautiful piece of surviving history.
Yeah.
You just know Kel deeply appreciates an object that can take a beating from nature and still show up to work the next day.
It's the ultimate Iron Man equipment. But the narrative quickly pivots back to modern chaos. They head up to Washington, D.C. to attend a professional women's hockey league game, watching the New York Sirens take on the Montreal Victoire.
Cardboredom mentioned this was his first time attending a PWHL game, and he was completely blown away by the cultural dynamic of the crowd.
It was unlike anything he'd seen in professional sports. He points out that if you go to a standard NHL game, the arena blasts maybe 5 seconds of heavy, aggressive pump-up music before a face-off.
The moment the puck drops, the music abruptly cuts out, and the crowd just goes silent and watches the play.
At this game, the music would cut for the puck drop, but the massive crowd refused to stop. Thousands of fans would just keep going, joyfully singing entire verses and choruses of the songs completely a cappella while the live hockey game was being played in front of them.
He marveled at how distinct and relentlessly positive the fan culture was.
It's a great observation about how different communities interact with the same sport. But as they return to their hometown of Williamsburg, the everyday absurdities start stacking up in a way that feels less joyful and more ominous.
The universe just starts throwing strange, slightly menacing things at them.
The local encounters get so weird. A massive, aggressive nest of bald-faced hornets decides to build their home in the branches of the exact tree directly overlooking his kid's school bus stop.
Then, during an evening cheerleading competition for his daughter, they look up into the night sky expecting to see stars.
And instead see a massive, eerie line of Starlink satellites zooming overhead in perfect, unnatural formation. It feels like the sky is glitching.
And you cannot forget the surreal imagery from their trip to Busch Gardens.
Right. The Busch Gardens theme park is practically in their backyard, and they visit during the park's massive Christmastown event.
Now, there's a roller coaster there called Verbolten, which is themed around a terrifying high-speed drive through the haunted Black Forest.
At the entrance to the ride, as a thematic prop, there is a completely wrecked, heavily dented 1970s Porsche 911 that looks like it smashed head-on into a tree at 100 miles an hour.
And because it is the holiday season and the park management dictates that everything must be festive, the staff's solution is to take this crumpled, immobile symbol of vehicular disaster and just wrap it in hundreds of twinkling Christmas lights that perfectly match the paint job.
Cardboardum takes a photo where he tucks the Cal Ripken card right into the light strings resting on the crumpled hood of the Porsche.
It's this hilarious, uncomfortable blend of high-speed disaster and forced corporate holiday cheer.
It's the perfect transition point for the entire year, because from the moment they leave that wrecked Porsche, the focus of the Chronicle takes a sharp, metallic turn away from quirky family outings.
It moves directly into the realm of aviation, military hardware, and the undeniable escalation of Billy's chaotic influence. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Cardboardum ends up spending a significant amount of time around aircraft this year. He hits up the local commuter airport, walking the tarmac, and finds some incredible, unusual machines.
He spots a family displaying a pair of matching Soviet Yak-52 training planes.
He finds a massive 1980s Mitsubishi MU-2 Marquise, which is this beast of a multi-engine turboprop that looks like it belongs to a cartel boss.
And he photographs Billy sitting on the wing of an Icon A-5. Which is a truly fascinating piece of modern engineering.
It's a lightweight, amphibious two-seater plane featuring a rear-facing pusher propeller, and the wings can actually fold backwards so you can tow it behind a truck.
Wait, a plane that folds up for a trailer? How fast does something like that even go?
Not fast at all. Its top speed is only about 120 knots, which translates to just under 140 miles per hour. It's essentially designed to be a recreational flying jet ski.
It's meant for gentle landings on calm lakes.
Which is a cool piece of tech, but Billy clearly has a need for something a little more destructive than a flying jet ski. He wants noise. He wants violence.
So the family heads over to Joint Base Langley Eustace for a massive military air show.
Now we are firmly in the territory of I Heart Jet Noise, bumper stickers, and the smell of aviation fuel.
The sheer auditory assault of a military air show is something that vibrates right through your chest. Cal, ever the patriot and rule follower, makes sure to stand at quiet attention for the national anthem.
He respectfully watches the parachute demonstration teams execute precise, mathematically calculated formation jumps out of the back of massive, thumping Chinook helicopters.
But Billy.
Billy is there for the shock and awe. He is absolutely captivated by the simulated bombing runs. F-22 Raptors are flying dangerously low over the airfield, tearing the sky apart with their engines, cruising with their weapons bays wide open, and dropping pyrotechnics that send massive concussive booms echoing across the concrete.
But the pivotal moment of the day, the moment that shifts the entire tone of the project, happens while they are walking the static displays on the tarmac.
Billy zeroes in on a specific fighter jet.
Right, he spots an F-16 belonging to the Air National Guard's 119th Fighter Squadron.
And what is the official moniker of the 119th? The Jersey Devils.
Yeah.
The tail insignia painted on the jet is a literal grinning red devil.
Cardboardum notes that just before they walk away from the aircraft, Cal catches Billy and the painted devil exchanging a respectful, silent nod of recognition.
That nod is the turning point. It is the moment the chaos stops being a series of funny, disjointed coincidences and starts feeling actively malevolent and directed.
Billy is on a mission now, and the tone of the entire year shifts dramatically into darkness.
It happens almost immediately. Billy somehow wrests control of the family calendar. He announces that he wants to take everyone out for some history lessons, much like Cal did earlier in the year.
First, they go to the Yorktown waterfront, where a beautiful wooden sailing ship is docked. But it's not a standard historical reenactment or an educational tour.
They have walked right into the middle of the Yorktown Pirate Festival.
You have a massive crowd of heavily costumed pirates swarming the docks, drinking and shouting.
Billy is actively trying to get Cardboardum's young, impressionable children to enlist as powder monkeys on a pirate ship.
He demands to get his picture taken, nestled securely inside the ribcage of a prop pirate skeleton that is locked inside a hanging metal gibbet.
They even encounter a guy walking through the crowd in full, historically accurate Viking gear. When asked what he's doing at a pirate festival, the guy tells them, completely deadpan, that he was pillaging long before pirates made it cool.
But the pirate festival is just the warm-up act. Shortly afterward, Billy announces to the family that they are going to church.
They drive an hour west to Richmond. Cal is probably already raising an eyebrow, expecting a trick. They end up at a local pizzeria built into an old converted warehouse.
They grab a large cheese pizza and sit outside to eat it on a very oddly flat piece of land in an otherwise hilly, uneven area of the city.
And right between slices of pizza, Billy reveals the dark punchline of his joke. They aren't at a church. They're sitting directly on top of a mass grave.
I need you to break down the history of this specific location, because when I read this part, it gave me chills. It is incredibly dark.
They were sitting on the former roadbed of the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad. A century ago, the tracks ran right past that exact spot and straight into the Churchill Tunnel.
This was a massive infrastructure project designed to carry heavy coal trains under the city of Richmond and out toward the ports in Newport News.
But the tunnel was an absolute engineering nightmare from the very day it was built. It was bored through a treacherous layer of blue marl clay that expanded when wet.
It was plagued by frequent, terrifying cave-ins that disrupted rail traffic for decades.
So the railroad eventually decides they can't keep patching it. In 1925, they commit to fixing it once and for all.
Exactly. They send in a massive work train, complete with flat cars and a steam locomotive, along with a crew of nearly 200 men.
Their job is to widen the bore and heavily reinforce the inner lining of the tunnel with concrete.
And while they are hundreds of feet inside the earth, the absolute worst-case scenario unfolds. The ceiling gives way. The tunnel suffers a catastrophic structural collapse.
The earth just opens up and swallows them in the dark.
Yes. The sheer terror of that moment is unimaginable. Most of the 200 men manage to scramble over the debris and out into the daylight in the ensuing panic. But several workers and the entire work train itself were crushed and trapped under tons of suffocating earth.
Rescue efforts began immediately, with men digging frantically.
But the structural integrity of the entire hill was completely compromised. The frantic digging caused further collapses. The earth shifted so violently that buildings on the surface above the tunnel, including a portion of a literal church, collapsed and tumbled down into the sinkhole.
Hence Billy's incredibly morbid joke about taking the family to church.
It's a pitch-black sense of humor. Eventually, the situation became so unstable and dangerous that authorities made the agonizing, controversial decision to completely abandon the rescue efforts.
The missing men were left entombed inside the collapse.
The western end of the tunnel, just dozens of yards from where the family is casually sitting, eating their cheese pizza, was permanently sealed shut with a massive wall of concrete.
And Cardboardum posts a photo of it. It's this sealed concrete archway hidden in the woods, covered in ivy. And because the collapsed bore behind it is flooded with water, the groundwater is just constantly weeping and seeping through the porous concrete wall.
It looks like the earth itself is bleeding water. And Billy brought the family there for a fun weekend lunch outing.
Cal watches this happen and realizes things are getting wildly out of hand. The balance of the wallet is shifting far too heavily toward chaos.
So when Easter Sunday rolls around, Cal puts his foot down. He demands a wholesome, pristine, family-friendly activity that Billy cannot possibly profane or ruin.
He selects a children's Easter egg hunt taking place on the pristine, manicured turf of William and Mary's Zabel Stadium.
It sounds absolutely foolproof. Brightly colored plastic eggs scattered on a football field. Church bells ringing softly in the distance.
A crowd of eager children in their Sunday best waiting for the starting gun. But when they arrive, Billy just looks at the serene scene, smiles, and says, "Challenge accepted."
Initially, the egg hunt goes off without a hitch. The kids sprint across the turf faster than NFL wide receivers, grab their candy-filled eggs, and everything seems perfectly fine.
Cal is feeling confident. He suggests they walk over to the adjacent field and catch the college's afternoon baseball game to finish out a perfect, serene, baseball-centric Sunday.
But Cal underestimates the chemical volatility of children who have just consumed massive amounts of Easter chocolate. The sugar rush peaks and crack is hard.
They make it to the fifth inning of a tense, tied 5-5 game before the kids hit a wall and demand to go home immediately.
Game is officially in the book, so Cal agrees, and they start walking through the stadium parking lot.
And that is when they hear the sound. Was it the sharp ping of an aluminum bat making perfect contact, or was it the sound of the metaphorical fractured bell finally, irrevocably cracking wide open?
It was the deafening sound of shattering glass. Right at that exact moment, a William & Mary freshman named Jamie Laskowski steps up to the plate and hits an absolute bomb.
It is his very first NCAA career home run.
The ball clears the stadium wall, flies deep into the parking lot, and completely obliterates the rear window of a parked Dodge Caravan, just steps away from where the family is walking.
The scene turns to absolute chaos. A relief pitcher actually has to sprint out of the bullpen, jump the fence, and run into the parking lot to join them in searching through the shattered glass inside the minivan to recover the milestone baseball for the kid.
And Billy is just sitting there in the wallet, grinning at the distraction.
Cardboardum writes that at this exact moment, there was no doubting it anymore. Ever since God's finger touched his bat at the Michelangelo exhibit, or maybe since he exchanged that silent nod with the Jersey Devil Jet, Billy had stopped being just a baseball card.
He had evolved. He had become a sigil, a magical talisman that actively invited, attracted, and magnified uncontrollable, escalating chaos wherever he went.
And that chaos was about to go cross-country. Cardboardum's work conferences take him westward, specifically to Las Vegas. The wallet cards find themselves out on the neon-soaked Vegas Strip.
From a pedestrian footbridge near the MGM Grand, they look out over a massive, excavated dirt construction site filled with towering cranes.
It's the future site of the stadium for the relocating Athletics. A deeply poignant sight for any baseball fan, representing the death of a historic era in Oakland and the birth of something new.
But Billy doesn't care about stadium politics. His focus is strictly on culinary chaos.
Cardboardum confesses that despite taking many trips out west over the years, he had never actually eaten at an In-N-Out burger. Cal tries to keep things restrained by ordering a sensible meal and Diet Cokes.
But Billy grabs the wheel. He quickly graduates Cardboardum from ordering standard double-double burgers to demanding everything on the menu be prepared. Animal style.
Wait, for those of us who have never lived on the West Coast, what exactly does animal style do to a burger? It sounds messy.
Oh, it destroys any semblance of a clean meal. They take the mustard and fry it directly into the beef patty on the grill. Then they bury the burger under a massive pile of caramelized grilled onions, extra pickles, and an excessive amount of their signature secret sauce.
It is delicious, but it is certainly a massive step away from moderation. But the true masterpiece of Vegas food chaos happens the next morning at a notoriously trendy breakfast spot called Eggslet.
This story is incredible. They are waiting in a massive, slowly moving line for 49 minutes just to get a breakfast sandwich.
And standing right in front of them in line is a young woman who is aggressively live streaming and updating her Instagram followers about how unbelievably hungover her best friend is.
She keeps loudly referring to herself as an absolute angel for trekking down to fetch breakfast for her friend, who is apparently still upstairs in the hotel room suffering the severe physical consequences of the Vegas nightlife.
Because seating in the restaurant is so incredibly limited, Cardboardum and Billy actually end up having to awkwardly share a small table with this exact Instagrammer.
But she isn't eating. She's just obsessively checking her social media metrics on her phone, while the expensive sandwich meant for her sick friend rapidly cools off on the table.
Finally, she decides she's hungry and takes a massive bite of her own sandwich, a menu item called the Fairfax, which is packed to the brim with soft, incredibly runny scrambled eggs.
She raises the sandwich to her mouth, takes a huge bite, and the pressure causes the entire soft scrambled contents to shoot completely out the back of the bun.
And slide rapidly all the way down her forearm and onto her clothes.
Cardboardum writes that he could actually hear Billy laughing from inside his pocket.
Yeah.
As he silently handed her a napkin and walked away from the table.
The universe delivers immediate messy karma, seemingly orchestrated by a baseball card. And the surreal Vegas experiences just keep coming.
Back in the hotel room, Cardboardum finds himself sitting on a bizarre piece of furniture. a couch shaped exactly like the hookah-smoking caterpillar from Alice in Wonderland.
And he inspects the hotel room's automated minibar. He posts a photo of Billy sitting next to the items available for purchase, and he poses a profound mathematical question to his readers. What exactly does the Venn diagram look like for hotel guests who simultaneously purchase the $14 bag of premium quality beef jerky and the soda can-sized intimacy kit sitting right next to it?
It's a combination of items that paints a very specific, very chaotic picture of 3.0 AM Vegas decision making.
But the humor of the trip quickly evaporates on the journey home. The chaos nearly turns deadly.
Right. They are on a connecting flight, sitting on a massive Airbus A321. The plane lines up on the runway, the pilots throttle up the engines for takeoff, and then one of the engines completely and violently loses power.
The atmosphere in the cabin changes instantly. The cabin crew immediately snaps into emergency mode.
Cardboardham describes watching the flight attendants take their positions at the emergency exit doors. They're communicating across the length of the cabin using only rapid, precise hand signals.
The only movement of their lips is a silent, terrifying headcount of the passengers in their zones. They are fully preparing for an aborted takeoff and the deployment of the emergency evacuation slides.
It is a genuinely terrifying moment where you realize you have zero control, and the dual nature of the cards reacts perfectly to the terror.
Cal, representing order, procedure, and survival, is mentally reviewing the laminated safety card and identifying the nearest exits to aim for when the inevitable panic starts.
And Billy, what is his emergency protocol?
Billy is looking out the airplane window into the darkness of the tarmac, screaming at the Grim Reaper, "Hey, Death, come closer. I've got an autograph for you right here on this bat."
He is literally taunting his own mortality.
Yeah.
He wants the crash.
Thankfully, the flight deck determines the failed engine isn't going to catch fire or pose an immediate danger to the grounded plane, so the sheer panic subsides, but they are trapped sitting on a closed runway for hours while the plane is inspected.
And during this tense, multi-hour wait on a broken airplane, the absurdity returns. Billy points out the woman sitting in the window seat in the row directly in front of them.
She is completely unfazed by the near miss with the emergency slides.
Why? Because she is deeply engrossed in reading a highly explicit firefighter-themed erotic novel on her e-reader. As Cardboardham dryly notes, I guess she was prepared to meet some first responders.
It's a brilliant, bizarre detail that underscores the reality distortion field that seems to constantly surround Billy. And that distortion field extends to family events, too.
Shortly after returning, they drive to attend a cousin's wedding.
But this isn't a normal wedding in a church or a banquet hall. The cousin is a former Disney Parks entertainer, and she mandates that the entire event be a fantasy court-themed wedding. All the guests are required to wear full, elaborate fantasy costumes.
Cardboardham describes walking into a room filled with 75 women, completely decked out in intricate earcuffs, corsets, and iridescent fey wings.
He advises the male listeners that if they don't instantly understand the specific, intense energy of that room, they should go to their local library and ask the first female librarian they see to explain it to them.
It's a very specific high fantasy vibe. Cardboardham sneaks away from the swarm of fairy wings to take photos of Billy interacting with the hotel's antique architecture.
He finds an original, century-old Otis elevator control box with brass dials and a bank of vintage wooden telephones.
But amazingly, amidst all the elves, wizards, and fae, there is one single anchor to the baseball world.
A groomsman who is tasked with a speaking role during the ceremony is wearing a minor league baseball hat, specifically a brightly colored W Rocket City Trash Pandas hat.
Why is he wearing this at a fantasy wedding? Because he collects minor league hats and needed something to keep his hair from blowing around in the wind before the ceremony began.
It's the one tiny ridiculous anchor to the baseball world in a sea of fantasy cosplay. But the travel schedule wasn't done yet. Cardboardham had promised his readers that 2025 would be a year of excess, and he delivered with what he calls big travel.
The family goes on a massive two-week vacation halfway across the Pacific to Hawaii.
For a family whose idea of a big trip is usually driving a few hours down to the Outer Banks, Hawaii is a massive logistical leap.
They embrace the culture completely, eating massive, comforting bowls of udon noodles and fresh poke, visiting agricultural farms to eat every imaginable pineapple and macadamia nut treat.
And learning quirky local facts, like the fact that cardinals, the birds in Hawaii, are actually gray, not red.
They spend hours climbing through the cramped quarters of the battleship Missouri and the Bowfin submarine at Pearl Harbor.
Cardboardham's son even gets to sit in the cockpit of an authentic F-5 fighter jet. But the expert in me knows you want to talk about what they saw in Hangar 79 at the Pacific Aviation Museum.
Absolutely. They encounter an artifact known as the Swamp Ghost. This is a legendary piece of aviation history that hits right at the core of the wallet card philosophy.
It is an American B-17 Flying Fortress bomber that crash-landed in a remote, completely inaccessible swamp in Papua New Guinea way back in 1942.
It sat there, rotting in the humid muck, completely swallowed by the jungle for decades before it was finally salvaged, disassembled, and brought to Hawaii.
The photos he posts of it are incredible. The plane is heavily weathered, the metal is stained and scarred, but the most striking detail is that the massive metal propellers on the engines are violently bent completely backwards from the sheer force of hitting the swamp water at high speed.
It is a visceral physical record of a violently chaotic event. It wasn't restored to look shiny and new, it bears the scars of its history. It is a perfect monument for Billy to appreciate.
But apparently, looking at relics of destruction wasn't chaotic enough for Billy. He demands action on this vacation.
Oh, he does. He convinces the family to go to the North Shore, get on a boat, and jump into the open Pacific Ocean to swim with apex predators.
Cardboardham posts photos of holding the Billy card out over the deep blue water as an 8-foot Galapagos shark glides menacingly just beneath the surface. You can practically feel the card getting splashed with salt water.
But looking at sharks from the safety of a protective cage wasn't enough to satisfy the bell. As they are taking an Uber back to their hotel from the harbor, the driver casually asks if they plan on doing any hiking during their stay.
Cardboardham writes that he hears the metaphorical bell ring loudly in his head. Billy is grumpily elbowing him from inside the wallet, angry that no one got eaten by a shark, and demanding a human sacrifice.
So Cardboardham looks at the driver and says, "We're thinking about doing Cocoa Head tomorrow," and the mood in the car instantly changes.
The driver's polite smile drops. He tries to look diplomatic as he assesses the physical fitness of his passengers in the rearview mirror.
He clears his throat and very politely tries to talk them out of it, warning them that the trail might actually be closed because someone just fell into one of the bunkers near the top and had to be airlifted off the mountain by a rescue helicopter.
But Cardboardham channels his inner Tyler Durden and replies, "It's all right, it's just me going up." The driver is visibly relieved that the kids aren't going to be subjected to it and agrees to drop him off at the base.
Now, I need to explain what the Cocoa Crater Tramway actually is, because calling it a hike is a massive understatement. It is a brutal, punishing physical ordeal.
You are climbing the exposed southern slope of Cocoa Crater. This is an extinct volcano that stands 1,200 feet tall. It used to be even taller before it literally blew itself apart in a massive cataclysmic eruption 7,000 years ago.
And the trail isn't a winding dirt path with nice, easy switchbacks.
Not at all. During World War II, the military needed to build a radar station and a network of bunkers at the very summit. To get heavy supplies up there, they built a railroad tramway straight up the side of the volcano.
The hike consists of climbing those abandoned, splintering wooden railroad ties. The entire path is less than a mile long, but it goes in a perfectly straight line straight up the mountain. The average grade of the climb is 27 degrees.
Which is steep enough to burn your lungs, but the final section is an absolute nightmare.
The last quarter of the climb covers hundreds of feet of elevation, where the grade surpasses 50 degrees. At that point, you aren't walking anymore. You are literally using the railroad tracks as a ladder, pulling your body weight up hand over hand.
And you're doing this completely exposed to the blistering, unshaded tropical sun. Think about the sweat soaking through a pocket onto a piece of 1980s cardboard.
Cardboardham notes that as a Virginia native, the heat and humidity didn't bother him too much. But the psychological aspect is intense. The base of the volcano backs right up to a local firing range.
So as you are dragging yourself up this 50-degree incline, your heart pounding out of your chest, your legs screaming, the entire soundtrack to your suffering is the relentless, echoing crack of constant gunfire ringing out across the valley.
It is a crucible. He posts photos looking back down the steep tracks, and the people on the trail behind him are literally crawling on their hands and knees just to get to the summit bunkers. It is an exercise in pure, punishing endurance.
I complain when the aisles at a card show are too long. I cannot fathom dragging myself up a volcano. After surviving Cocoa Crater, Cal is completely exhausted. He has reached his limit. He needs a break.
So Billy takes over completely.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Billy's chaotic energy demands an outlet, and that outlet becomes a relentless, eardrum-shattering onslaught of heavy metal and shock rock.
The bell is ringing constantly now, but as Scarbordum says, it doesn't count as a death knell if you were enthusiastically beating a drum solo on it. The back half of the year effectively becomes the Scarbordum World Tour.
The lineup of bands these vintage baseball cards witnessed is absurd. If you sent a card to a grading company, you'd never admit it had been to these places. We are talking Alice Cooper, Judas Priest, Lamb of God, Gwar, Hatebreed, Ghost, The Dwarves, Helmet, Corrosion of Conformity. It's a cardboard mosh pit.
It kicks off at a new outdoor amphitheater built right on the waterfront in downtown Richmond. The headliners for the evening are Lamb of God and Gwar, two legendary metal bands that actually formed just blocks away from the venue. It's a homecoming show.
Cardboardum notes that Lamb of God was playing with absolute venom that night. Ozzy Osbourne had passed away just days prior, and the band had just returned from playing an emotional Ozzy tribute concert in Birmingham. They were channeling all that grief and aggressive energy directly into the set.
And the venue's location added to the sensory overload. It's situated right next to an active railroad viaduct. In the middle of the deafening metal set, an actual, literal freight train comes rolling past the stage, and the train engineer is hanging out the window of the locomotive, throwing the heavy metal horn hand signs at the roaring crowd.
You haven't truly headbanged until a 1,000-ton freight train rolls through the mosh pit. The tour continues in Virginia Beach with an incredible twin bill, Alice Cooper and Judas Priest.
Cardboardum marvels at Alice Cooper's stagecraft. It's not just loud music. It's a meticulously timed theatrical magic show full of sleight of hand, culminating in Cooper's trademark onstage guillotine beheading, all driven by the incredible shredding guitar work of Nita Strauss.
And then Judas Priest takes the stage, with Rob Halford riding out under the blinding lights on a roaring motorcycle.
But the undisputed crown jewel of the world tour requires a rapid, exhausting redeployment back across the country. Cardboardum executes a frantic 48-hour sprint flying into Las Vegas, sprinting through the Denver airport to make a tight connection, all for a singular mission, to see the masked, highly theatrical rock band Ghost at the MGM Grand.
And he fully commits to the bit. He dons black clothing fastened with an alarming number of zippers and laces and lines up 6 hours before showtime to join a massive crowd of 20,000 fans. He describes the atmosphere not as a menacing metal show, but as a massive, joyful Halloween party.
The fan culture surrounding Ghost is incredibly dedicated to elaborate cosplay and deep, intricate band lore. Cardboardum observes people in the crowd painting their faces to recreate classic religious tableaus. He sees women in full, elegant ball gowns and opera gloves standing next to people dressed as priests, monks, and sisters of sin.
He spots a guy dressed as Larry the Cucumber from VeggieTales, multiple people dressed as Jesus, and my personal favorite, a dwarf cosplaying as Satan in a brilliant, glittering, red sequined tuxedo.
You cannot make that up. And because Ghost lore involves their frontman, the satanic pope character Papa Emeritus, hiding secret messages inside his papal robes, the cosplayers immediately recognize the kindred spirit of the Billy Ripken error card.
Cardboardum photographs Billy tucked inside the suit jacket of a very accurate Papa Emeritus V cosplayer. Stitched inside the silk lining of the jacket in massive white block letters is a giant F you, a direct, perfect mirror of the obscenity written on Billy's bat.
The concert itself is a sensory spectacle. It's strictly a no-phone show, meaning the crowd is entirely present in the moment. The venue is serving bright red cocktails in literal medical blood bags, using IV lines as straws.
An elderly man is navigating the chaotic pit with an aluminum walker while wearing a vintage Misfits shirt, proving Billy's motto that punk never dies. At one point, a woman dressed as a nun wearing black lipstick trips and falls directly into Cardboardum's lap, actually putting a new physical crease into Billy's cardboard.
It's pure, joyous chaos. But when he returns home to Richmond, the heavy metal pilgrimage gets surprisingly personal. His day job requires him to tour a newly constructed office building located near the historic Jackson Ward neighborhood. This puts him in direct striking distance of the North American lair of the legendary shock rock band, Gwar.
So naturally, he walks over to Gwar Bar, the dive bar owned and operated by the band themselves.
The visual juxtaposition inside this bar is incredible. You have original, heavily blood-stained foam latex stage props hanging from every available surface. He photographs the billy card sitting on a table directly underneath the actual black guitar that belonged to the late Corey Smoot, who played the character Flatus Maximus.
It's a museum of gore. And working the taps, Mike Dirks, the legendary guitarist known to the world as the bear trap-wearing monster Ballsack, the Jaws of Death, is casually tending the bar, pouring beers.
And what is playing on the television above the bar while this heavy metal legend pours drinks among the gory stage props? The Hallmark Channel.
It is the ultimate display of irony. Card Boredom even climbs a rusted fire escape outside the building to look through a second-story window where a full-size, terrifying mannequin of the late great frontman Odorous Urungus stands guard over the street. It's a literal shrine to chaos.
But the chaos was about to be harnessed for a greater purpose. Because for the grand finale of the year, Good and Evil Cal and Billy finally stop bickering inside the wallet and team up. They pool their opposing energies to orchestrate what Card Boredom calls the perfect masterpiece kidnapping for his wife's birthday.
To understand the sheer magnitude of what they pull off, you have to understand the target. Card Boredom's wife is a fascinating, deeply intellectual person. She is a brilliant academic who teaches graduate-level British literature. She is a card-carrying member of the Jane Austen Society who will casually wear a period-accurate Empire waist gown to events.
She treats Halloween and the movies Hocus Pocus and The Nightmare Before Christmas with a reverence most people reserve for religious high holy days. She grew up reading Goosebumps and graduated to a deep scholarly obsession with the darkest, grittiest gothic tales of the Victorian era. As Card Boredom puts it, he somehow managed to marry an out-of-his-league blonde goth with a serious library card.
And he wanted to give her the ultimate gift to honor that. 14 years ago, they attended a party at a historic mansion boasting an incredible library of curated first editions. She spent hours mesmerized by the books, carefully turning the pages. That day, Card Boredom made a silent vow to find her a true first edition of one of her absolute favorite novels.
But antiquarian books of that era are incredibly expensive and notoriously difficult to authenticate. So for 14 years, which is a streak longer than Cal Ripken's legendary consecutive games played record, Card Boredom secretly studied the rare book market. Every single paycheck for over a decade, he quietly siphoned $20 into a hidden fund. Think about that math. 14 years of paychecks. That's thousands of dollars squirreled away 20 bucks at a time.
The long-term dedication is astounding. And in 2024, he finally tracked down The White Whale, an 1854 first edition of Elizabeth Gaskell's novel North and South. This is the Victorian era's gritty industrial answer to Pride and Prejudice, famously published under the heavy-handed editorial guidance of Charles Dickens himself.
Card Boredom makes an analogy specifically for the collectors listening to us right now to put this in perspective. Tracking down, authenticating, and purchasing this pristine 1854 first edition was the exact emotional and financial equivalent of hunting down a genuine 1952 Topps Mickey Mantle.
It is a masterpiece artifact. But simply handing her a wrapped book in their living room wasn't enough. Billy and Cal, operating as teammates, devise an elaborate theatrical delivery system. Cal provides the meticulous, detail-oriented long-term planning, and Billy provides the chaotic, theatrical misdirection.
The execution of this plan is a masterclass in deception. Card Boredom secretly coordinates with her boss to clear her calendar a full year in advance. He arranges for the grandparents to watch the kids. He feeds her just enough false information to make her believe they are taking a rustic, romantic road trip to see the fall foliage in the Blue Ridge Mountains. He even goes so far as to leave fake printouts of reservations for a mountain lodge and horseback riding on the home printer for her to accidentally discover.
She fully buys into it. She packs her hiking boots and flannel shirts. They get in the car on the morning of her birthday, and Card Boredom hits play on a specific playlist.
But hitting play does more than just start the music, right?
Yes. This is pure James Bond villainy. Hitting play triggers a hidden coding script running in the background of his phone.
You've got to be kidding me. A custom script.
A custom script? It instantly blasts out automated text messages to her entire social circle, friends, family, coworkers, informing them that the Blue Ridge trip is a complete lie, Operation Birthday Surprise is officially underway, and they are all now drafted as accomplices.
45 minutes into the drive, they approach a fork in the highway. Card Boredom turns to her, tells her he knows exactly how much she loves a good story and that she is now the protagonist of one. He aggressively yanks the steering wheel, abandoning the route to the mountains, and takes the exit for the airport.
Before she can even process what is happening or object, a porter is pulling hidden luggage out of the trunk, and her phone explodes with text messages from her friends begging to know where she is flying. She doesn't find out the true destination until they are walking down the jet bridge. They are flying to Boston.
But the misdirection doesn't stop at the airport. They land in Boston, a black SUV picks them up, and the driver spins a tale about driving them out to the Berkshires for the foliage. Then, right in front of Boston Common, the SUV supposedly breaks down. The driver apologizes, hands them a pre-written note, and tells them the hotel across the street will take care of them.
They walk into the lobby, hand the note to the concierge, and the concierge smiles knowingly and says, "Greetings, Mrs. Cardboardham. Your arrival has been expected." They're standing in the ornate lobby of the Parker House Hotel.
The historical and literary weight of the Parker House cannot be overstated, which makes it the absolute perfect setting for this literary kidnapping. It is the oldest continuously operating hotel in the nation. This was the headquarters for the Saturday Club, the legendary intellectual gathering where giants like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Nathaniel Hawthorne debated their works and essentially birthed American literature.
Mark Twain practically lived there. And most importantly, for a lover of Victorian Gothic tales, when Charles Dickens decamped from London to America, he made the Parker House his home base. It was in this very building that Dickens gave his first public American performance of A Christmas Carol,
which at its core is a ghost story. And right on cue, as they are discussing this incredible literary history over dinner, a literal ghost appears at their table. It's an actor in spectral makeup carrying a lantern who beckons her outside for a nighttime ghost tour of downtown Boston's graveyards and infamous murder sites.
And the ghost tour leads them right back to their own hotel. The Parker House is renowned as one of the most haunted buildings in New England. It's heavily rumored to be the inspiration for Stephen King's terrifying short story, 1408. The wife falls asleep that night wondering about the elevators that supposedly stop on random floors to let off blasts of freezing air and a legendary apparition of the woman in red roaming the massive hallways.
The next morning, the birthday surprises escalate even further. They walk through Beacon Hill and approach an imposing heavy stone building. Her phone is secretly put into airplane mode while his phone blasts another automated update to the accomplices. She should get out of jail around 11.
Because they're eating breakfast at Clink, a luxury restaurant built directly into the preserved cell blocks of the former Charles Street Jail.
They're sitting at a table surrounded by original heavy iron bars and exposed brickwork. This building functioned as a brutal penitentiary for over 120 years. The suffragettes were imprisoned here. James Curley, the notoriously corrupt Boston mayor, served his sentence in these cells and actually ran his re-election campaign and won from behind these exact bars.
The history of that building is wild. Cardboardham posts a photo of Billy leaning against the iron bars of the specific cell where Babe Ruth once had to sleep off a bender after being arrested for being drunk and disorderly. Think about that. A baseball card posing in the very cell that held the Bambino. And it is right here, inside a literal jail cell, that Cardboardham finally presents the masterpiece gift, the pristine 1854 first edition of North and South.
They are having a beautiful emotional moment discussing the book. Cardboardham casually mentions that the novel famously begins with two false starts. That phrase is the final hidden cue.
The waitress rushes the table, but she isn't bringing coffee or the check. She is acting terrified. She hands the wife a piece of aged, crinkled parchment. It's a letter warning her that the hotel is cursed, dark forces are looking for her, and she needs to flee Boston immediately. She must find the boatman. The letter is signed simply A.
The waitress aggressively urges them to run.
Yeah.
The leisurely, emotional breakfast instantly turns into a frantic sprint to the Boston Wharf. They board a ferry, and Cardboardham hands her a tablet and a pair of headphones.
She hits play, and a custom video starts rolling. It recaps the insane past 24 hours, the fake hiking trip, the airport, the haunted hotel, the jailhouse breakfast. The narrator addresses her directly, telling her that everything so far has just been theatrical misdirection. Then an iconic image flashes on the screen, the shadow of a witch flying over the water. The video announces she is leaving Boston for the spellbinding charm of Salem.
At that exact moment, her phone comes off airplane mode and absolutely explodes with messages from her social circle. The final destination has been revealed. Salem, Massachusetts, at the absolute peak of the Halloween season.
And the itinerary he has planned is a goth literature lover's absolute dream. They arrive at the historic Pickering House, and waiting inside to have tea with them is Vanessa Shaw, the actress who played Allison in the movie Hocus Pocus. They attend a massive nighttime Halloween bash in a historic barn where they hang out with Omri Katz and the rest of the cast who battled the Sanderson sisters.
They spend the next day reviewing original, horrifying documents from the Salem witch trials. They get caught in the middle of a massive zombie walk through the cobblestone streets. They have absolute carte blanche to shop at dark, esoteric boutiques.
Card Boredom posts these amazing photos to prove it. There's a guy in full, terrifying Pennywise the Clown makeup holding the Billy Ripken card. There's a photo of the local Salem houses elaborately decorated for Halloween, featuring massive 12-foot-tall skeletons walking skeleton dogs on leashes. And because it's Massachusetts, the skeletons are proudly wearing Boston Red Sox hats. It is the perfect, chaotic, beautiful culmination of Billy and Cal's teamwork.
But every story has an ending. The bell can only withstand so many strikes before the metal finally gives way. 3 weeks after the triumph in Salem, the bill comes due for Billy.
The final act. They take a trip to the Norva, a notoriously sweaty, standing-room-only concert venue in Norfolk, Virginia. Card Boredom knows exactly what is about to happen. He makes the conscious decision to leave Cal safely locked inside the car. As he puts it, Cal is left with a metaphorical warm glass of milk. This environment is not for him.
Card Boredom and Billy are both wearing pristine, bright white clothing. They walk inside and aggressively push their way right up to the front barricades.
The musical lineup for the show is absolute insanity. They watch a vampiric band fronted by comedian Jordan Olds. They survive a violently chaotic mosh pit during a set by the Dwarves, a punk band that Card Boredom accurately describes as what you would get if cocaine became sentient and started a band. Then Helmet takes the stage, and the crowd is so rowdy that a fan literally hurls a full pack of cigarettes directly at the bassist's head.
The tension in the room is palpable. And then the headliners emerge from the shadows. Guar takes the stage.
The undisputed kings of theatrical, blood-soaked shock rock, as the band launches into a crushing rendition of the Great Circus Train Disaster, Card Boredom reaches into his pocket. He pulls out the Billy Ripken card and holds it high in the air above the barricade, exposing it to the element.
And the bell shatters.
The band unleashes their hoses. Torrents of high pressure, freezing cold, fake blood gallons of heavily pigmented red and blue dye spray out over the screaming crowd. For 80 relentless minutes, Card Boredom is jumping, screaming, violently colliding with people in the pit, hauling fallen moshers off the sticky floor, and shoving others back into the fray. And the entire time, he never lets go of Billy.
Billy takes the full, unprotected brunt of the assault. The 1989 cardboard stock is completely saturated, physically fatigued beyond any hope of repair, crushed by the bodies in the pit, and stained permanently with the grotesque colors of the dye. If you sent this card to a grader, they wouldn't even know what to do with it.
Card Boredom writes that Cal wasn't distraught over the loss of his cardboard sibling. They all knew this was coming. There was simply no other way that a card featuring that specific obscenity, a card that lived a life of such aggressive, unrepentant chaos, could possibly meet its end. He went out exactly as he would have wanted, screaming obscenities into the darkness, completely covered in blood.
It is a glorious, fitting demise. And with Billy destroyed, Cal steps up. The Iron Man lives up to his legendary namesake, absorbing the burden and carrying out the remainder of the year alone, surviving intact until the final bell rings.
So what does this all mean?
It brings us to a really profound question about the physical objects we choose to value and how we interact with the history they absorbed. In the baseball card collecting hobby, we spend our entire lives obsessing over preservation. We take these fragile pieces of cardboard, we encapsulate them in hard, sonically sealed plastic slabs, and we lock them away in dark vaults to ensure their corners remain sharp, their edges are pristine, and their surfaces never see the light of day. But in our desperate attempt to protect the object, we completely isolate it from the human experience. A card sealed in a vault tells the sterile, statistical story of an athlete. A card carried through Coco Crater, ghost tours, and a Guar mosh pit tells the story of a life. It forces us to ask whether the true value of our possessions lies in their pristine condition or in the scars they gather alongside us.
Did the cards get bent in Card Boredom's pocket, or was it the world that bent around them? Go take your baseball cards for a walk. If you're feeling really adventurous, drag them through hell.